You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. A student who takes out $53,000, and that's the average, $53,000 for students attending four-year public universities, will, according to a new study published by the think tank Demos, experience a lifetime loss of wealth in excess of $200,000, $250,000. If you add that up across all of the student debt that you have in the United States, which is over $1 trillion worth, that means that the lifetime wealth loss in America of our students being so in debt is $4 trillion. You recall before Ronald Reagan came into office, about 80% of the cost of tuition was paid for by state, federal, local, and schools, state, federal, local governments and schools, and about 20% was paid for by the students. So you could work your way through school like my wife did as a waitress at Howard Johnson's, like I did as a part-time DJ, and pumping gas and working in a Bob's Big Boy on Trowbridge Road in East Lansing. Can't do that anymore because now you got to pay, you know, now students pay 80% of the cost of tuition, and state, local, federal governments and the colleges themselves pay about 20% of the cost of tuition. Created a bit of a mess, a train wreck, you might say. And Neil McCluskey, the associate director at the Cato Institute's Center for Educational Freedom, cato.org. Thinks he has a solution, and that's to... Hey, Neil, welcome to the program.
Yeah, my pleasure.
I'm guessing, you know, when libertarians say freedom, I'm guessing what you are saying is your solution to the problem is to say to all those students who need to borrow money to go to school, not that we're going to go back to the pre-Reagan times when most of college education was paid for by governments or by schools, but rather... good luck, Charlie. You're on your own. Government's not going to help you out, and go find a bankster.
Well, you know, that's the nice thing about being for freedom is you don't actually have to say, too bad, Charlie. What we see is, for one thing, the federal government's involvement in college has led to massive price inflation. So
no.
It's nice that the politicians talk about, well, we're going to give you lots of aid to go to school, but then we see the colleges and universities, both public and private, raise their prices at huge rates.
You are not only confusing correlation with causation, but you're missing the absolute reverse of that. The backing out of government from college tuition. Government used to pay 80% of the cost of college tuition. When Ronald Reagan came into office in 1980, look it up. Right now, government pays about 22% of the cost of college tuition. As government backed out of that, who had to step in? Students. As students had to step in and pay more and more for college, what did they have to do? Borrow. Yes, the government has been helping them borrow, but that's not what's driving the price up. What's driving the price up is the lack of government involvement.
Yeah, but that actually doesn't fit with any of the data.
Certainly
what
does.
The data shows you is that, first of all, state and local governments, at least for the last 25 years, have, with the exception of the last two or three years, greatly increased the amount of money they spend on higher education.
Well, that reflects inflation.
On a pretty flat trend for 25 years on a per pupil basis. Yet schools have raised their prices at rates far in excess of normal inflation, far in excess of even health care.
My point.
That is actually very clear.
My point. They've raised their rates.
Because the federal government makes sure students can pay it.
Yeah, if the cost of tuition is now being paid by students, because when you say they've raised their rates, they haven't actually raised the amount of money they're getting per student. What they've raised is the amount of that cost of education that is paid for by the student. And yes, that has increased about four to five fold because government support of that price of tuition has dropped four or five fold.
Well, let me give you another statistic, because I guess what I gave you already wasn't enough.
Well, you know, going from $16,700 a year to $39,500 a year, I think, you know, it's a $22,000 increase. That's the money that used to be paid by government that is now paid by students.
You can break down, actually, public colleges and universities, and you can say over the last 25 years, yes, you can say that they have lost some money on a per pupil basis. That's largely because enrollment has skyrocketed. But go ahead, and you can take that. So they lose, you know, say for every dollar they lose per pupil, public colleges and universities have raised their prices $2. And so that's with your worst case scenario. It's very clear that the colleges are raising their prices far in excess of what they're losing. Of course, and that doesn't explain private colleges and universities at all, because they weren't getting that public money at your time.
No, the private colleges,
again,
the for-profit colleges, we used to call diploma mills.
Make sure that every student can pay that. The data is really, it's really very, very clear on this point.
So if this is the case with education, why is it not the case with food?
Because the federal government doesn't say to everybody who's going to buy food, not only will we pay, give you the money for that food, but we'll give you as much money as you need for whatever price that food is.
No, no, the government's not giving anybody money. It's loaning people money. Food stamps, they're actually giving people money, 40 million of them. The price of food's not going up.
The federal government gives Pell Grants, for one thing. They also give tax credits, usually to generally wealthier people, which should be eliminated. But the important thing is they say, look, you want to go to college, whatever price they want to charge you right now, we'll make sure right now you have the money to pay that. Nobody does that for food. And
so are you suggesting
everybody the way that student aid does?
Are you suggesting that if the federal government got out of the student loan business, that instead of people taking out loans from Bank of America, that they would just stop going to college?
Well, that would all depend on the individual. I think that's something very important to understand.
Well, that's the cornerstone of your argument. I think it's nonsense.
Well, it's not. It's actually basic logic and basic economics. You would see the price of college go down. You would see some people who really weren't sure whether they needed to go to college say, I'm not going to do that. You'd see right now we have half of people, roughly, who go to college. We don't have great data on this, but roughly half who enroll in college don't finish. You have about a third of people with degrees, or bachelor's degrees, who are in jobs that don't require it. More very clear evidence of massive overconsumption of higher education.
Well, I would argue that the second statistic is conclusive evidence. If you got a third of people who have jobs that don't require a degree, then, you know, we've got a problem with our jobs market. Maybe we should be talking about changing our trade policies and bringing some of our jobs back home, so that not only are we doing manufacturing in this country, we're also doing the engineering and support services necessary for that, number one. And what was your first point?
I don't remember.
Yeah, okay.
It was very insightful.
Yes, no doubt it was.
I can't remember what it is.
But here's a simple question. It used to be in California, and actually in many places across the country, California was the most famous for it. It was the largest. I mean, it was the equivalent of many other countries. It used to be college was free, and until Reagan became governor. Why didn't, you know, and so that was, you know, 100% support of education. Why didn't that make things go nuts? I mean, everything seemed to be working just fine when college was free. Lincoln started this idea with land-grant colleges. We had free college in the United States for a long, long time.
Yeah, it's interesting, because if you look at land-grant colleges for over 30 years, they were a complete waste. In fact, I was just reading about this today in a great history of land-grant colleges. So people, you know, in Congress, that'd be great.
There's still over 50 of them.
You used them, and the instruction wasn't useful to most people. And part of that was because people didn't need that to have.
You're saying Michigan State University was a waste of time?
It certainly was. And if it had been needed,
I think the graduates of that college would disagree with you.
30 years, almost 30 years, of basically wasted time and wasted money.
So let's just say if you're a member of the Lucky Sperm Club, if you were born into Donald Trump or Charles Koch's family, you got opportunity. And if not, you either negotiate with a bankster or don't bother going to college.
Which has also not borne out the history of American education well before there was heavy government involvement.
You mean before Thomas Jefferson created the free University of Virginia?
The University of Virginia did not do anything.
It was free.
Through the Virginia education system, and he couldn't get the K-12. One of his people in Virginia were happy.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Neil McCluskey, you can read all about it at cato.org. Thank you, Neil.
My pleasure.
Past the hour. Welcome back. It's Anything Goes Friday, Anything Goes Summer, but I'm in this first hour, we had a conversation with the Heritage Foundation, or excuse me, with the Cato Institute, the former Charles Koch Foundation, renamed the Cato Institute. And in our third hour, We are going to have Mark Williams of the Tea Party Express is going to drop by, and we're going to be discussing Detroit. That should be entertaining. But, you know, in the spirit of Anything Goes Friday, let's pick up your calls. Mark in New York City. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Beautiful day here in New York. I hope it's nice.
It is here, too, in D.C.
Excellent. You know, there's just a couple of comments about all this craziness going on. It seems like the month of August is really a bad month for Democrats, historically. Ever since you had Al Gore, you know, flopping in August, you had John Kerry windsurfing in August. You know, it's kind of like a bad month. I hope this year turns out a little better.
Well, it's kind of a bad month all around. You know, Congress just adjourned. I was down on Capitol Hill this morning. We did a pre-taped interview with Congressman John Conyers. And, you know, the members of Congress fleeing that building. It's like, you know, look out.
it's like they brought out the can of Raid.
Yeah, it's like, you know, there's a five-week vacation coming. Boom! Yeah, exactly right. Cockroaches scattering. And it's
obscene. You know, the interesting thing about Detroit on one level is that these Republicans always chant mantra, states' rights, states' rights, states' rights, except when it's not convenient. Okay, as in, you know, Bush Gore, and now as in Detroit, where it's written in their state constitution that they can't monkey around with pensions.
That's right.
And they're just oblivious to it. You know?
But they've got a judge. I mean, they've got all these Republican appointed judges and Republican elected judges. They've got both varieties in Michigan. And they've got a judge now to say, well, it doesn't matter what the constitution says, you can still steal the workers' pensions.
Right. Now, hopping back to the student loan debacle. I think the important number for everyone to realize is that this year they expect to make a profit of $51 billion on student loans, which is greater than the profit of ExxonMobil.
Yeah.
Okay, so you have this obscene march towards privatization of everything when you have a president like Abraham Lincoln, start the land grants, like you had mentioned, that, you know, basically made education a right. You had the GI Bill after World War II, which basically made education a right, and they just want to turn everything upside down.
Yes, and it's really freedom.
Call it freedom.
Whenever you hear a libertarian or a Republican talk about freedom, what they mean is you're free if you're rich, and if you're not, good luck, Charlie. You know, if you're not, you're toast. Excellent point, Mark. Thanks a lot for calling and making it. Steve in Chicago. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I wanted to say, with regard to the discussion that you just had from the gentleman, I believe he was from the Cato Institute, this notion of education being, its value being purely a function of how much money one can make, and what's lost in that discussion.
Or how much money one is born with.
Yes, and the notion that in a civil society, it behooves us to produce educated people, not because they're going to make a great salary down the road. You know, I didn't get a value out of studying John Rawls and Immanuel Kant in college because I thought, you know, down the road, you know, some corporate employer is going to really have a utility for that. You know, but instead, that empowered me as an individual. It created more value for me intellectually. And down the road, I was able to make decisions based upon the kind of society I want, who I vote for. So, again, he never seems to want to talk about that. People like that don't want to talk about the issue of how education benefits us in ways that we can't quantify in terms of money.
Yeah. Well, excuse me. I totally agree with you, and I'm sorry. I touched the button, and boom, off you went. Ludwig in Orange, Connecticut. Hey, Ludwig, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. My pleasure.
Tom, I want to talk about Thomas Jefferson, one of your favorite people, and Alexander Hamilton and the competitiveness they had on the legality of the Bank of the United States.
Sure.
And Tom, I always wondered this from you, because I'm pretty well-read, and I have a lot of sources, and I'd be very interested in hearing what your overall opinion is, because I can't understand by some things you say. Do you agree or disagree that the United States is the only country that was actually founded as an empire?
That's a good question. How are you defining empire?
Well, there's been around 70 empires in human history. I would say with the control of money, the control of culture, the control of corporations. I mean, it's been a different form.
You know, using any of those definitions, Ludwig, I would disagree with that. I mean, George Washington was so explicit, even in his farewell message, don't even get involved with other countries. I always think of empire as, you know, expanding out, basically exploiting the natural resources of other countries and using military or economic conquest to do it. But in you know, however you want to describe it, I would say no.
Well,
why?
Well, let me just say one more thing, please, because I know you're busy. Let's use the definition that Noam Chomsky says, because I'm very interested in what your response would be. Say the Mississippi River was as wide as the Irish Sea, and they call that the saltwater fallacy, which means if you're not covering a body of water, then therefore it's not an empire. If the Mississippi River was as wide as the Irish Sea, would we have been an empire then?
I don't know. I think that's I think we're getting into, you know, playing with words here. It's
no. Well, let me give you a few sources. How's that?
Well, what's the point you're trying to make?
Are you interested? Are you interested?
Why does this matter? What's the point you're trying to make?
I'm making a point that I think you're a great guy. I think you mean well.
I know, but so what's the point?
My point is, once you set your mind on something, and where you could learn that we really are an empire and we were founded as an empire, and now that corporations control every resource in the world,
right.
We have 20 million children starving in the United States.
Right.
As you know, corporations have the rights as people. I love that book that you wrote about unequal opportunity or unequal. I just think that the one piece you're missing is that we've always been that way in some form. And
well, then, you know, whether you're right or wrong and whether I'm right or wrong, let's fix it.
Yes, absolutely. You got to go back to the beginning, is my point.
So you want to rewrite the Constitution?
No, go back to the beginning to see what the truth is from the start, and that will help us change it, is what I'm saying.
Okay. Well, it's worth an analysis. Ludwig, thank you for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Art, was the United States founded as an empire? Your thoughts? Feel free. 28 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And anything goes Friday, anything goes summer, whatever you want to call it. Anything goes anything. And let's see here. Alan in Joshua, Texas. Hey, Alan, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. First, I want to qualify this by saying that I'm not advocating any violence at all. But I'm writing. I haven't got it posted yet, but I'm writing up a petition to basically authorize and request our military to seize back control of our government and take it away from, you know, the corrupt robber, the modern day robber baron era, you know, corporate interests that have taken it over.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we look at the solution for corrupt government is really right there in the history of our country. The Boston Tea Party and the other protests were an appeal to the power structure, the founders, to organize and take action.
Right.
And, you know, just, you know, we need to be doing everything.
So are you suggesting that the military should take out? Did I understand this right, that the military should somehow reduce corporate power in government?
Well, if we look...
How does that work?
I think we need to be simulating what the early colonialists did to request and authorize our power structure to arrest and prosecute, you know, not only the politicians, but the corporate powers. Somehow, I mean...
So what you're talking about...
How else are we going to take our country back? I mean... And not advocating, I think that, you know, in some way, that's what all these protests are about.
I don't think so. It sounds to me like what you're suggesting is violent revolution.
Well, no, not if they just arrest, and that's not violent.
Well, if the government starts arresting its citizens, then
they're not arresting citizens, they're... you know, just the corporate entities.
Okay, let's make this real, Alan. Let's make this real. Bank of America has, you know, robo-signed. I mean, we can identify a bunch of actual violations of criminal code that Bank of America has done. What do you think the military should do to Bank of America?
I think that there has to be some sort of structure to come in and take back control of that somehow. Wouldn't you agree? How would you say that we should be able to do it if they control the vote and we can't do it through a vote because you have to be a multimillionaire to even get anybody in there to run?
Yeah.
How are we going to change it if we
authorize? No, Alan, if you're just suggesting that, you know, people within the military should rise up and say, okay, today we're going to decide that we're going to go into the Bank of America headquarters and we're going to arrest whoever the CEO is or all of the executives or something like that, that's kind of like what Egypt just did. And I don't think that Americans are, you know, would be all that happy about that. And frankly, there's a lot of citizens in the United States, so if you tried to arrest them, they would push back and not without some justification, and you would end up with an armed revolt. My suggestion, if you're saying that the problem is that our laws are not being enforced, I would agree with you. And this is the point that Elizabeth Warren made when she was interrogating members of the Obama administration's Justice Department and the banking regulators and saying, you know, why did you not prosecute these people using the criminal statutes that they had violated? Why did you not, you know, break up their companies? Why simply slap their wrists and hit them with fines? Why not take them at least to court and give them a jury, you know, a trial before a jury of their peers? And basically the answer that we got from the administration was, well, they're too big and we're afraid that they might destabilize the economy and all that kind of stuff. And I say that's nonsense. But I only think that the administration is going to start enforcing the laws when they get enough public pressure.
Well, you know, they've basically done what the founding fathers said, which is seize the government and legalize the
government. There's a world of difference, yeah. Alan. The founding fathers did not seize a government. They created a government out of nothing. We were an occupied colony. They overthrew occupiers. We are no longer an occupied country, a colony. We are now a sovereign nation. So if you're talking about overthrowing the government, you're talking about us overthrowing us. That's called civil war.
No, you misunderstood what I said, though. I said that the corporate powers had seized our government and legalized their crimes, which is what Thomas Jefferson said they were going to do, and they did.
Yeah, and they did it through the agency of the Supreme Court, by and large, and Congress has the power and the authority to fix that, but not the willingness, as you correctly point out, because the corporations own them. And again, I go back, you know, if you want a Jeffersonian solution, Jefferson, when he was, for example, when he was asked by Spencer Roan, you know, if the Supreme Court is not going to have the power of judicial review, if the Supreme Court isn't going to be the ultimate authority about what the Constitution says, who is? And Jefferson said, the people themselves. All power should rest with the people themselves. Now, what he was not saying was that the people should simply whip out their bandoliers, their pistols, and you know, go in guns a-blazing when they don't like things. What he was saying is that we want our political systems to have as much power as possible at the you know, as close to the ground as possible. And I agree with that. I see a citizens movement in MoveToAmend.org right now to amend the Constitution to say corporations are not people and money is not speech. That I think actually has a very real possibility of working. You've got 500 communities around the United States. You got a dozen states that have voted for this. People are on it. They get it. And that is a revolution every bit as much as the Reagan Revolution was a revolution and the FDR Revolution was a revolution, but it's not the violent revolution, the violent overthrow, the use of guns, the use of military force that I think that you're characterizing or advocating.
No, not so much. I don't really think it would come to violence, but I do think that the Boston Tea Party, and there were probably other protests as well, that did appeal to the power structure of our government. I mean,
we had no government at that time.
It led to an organization of government. But I think it was a direct appeal by the, and now that did lead to violence, but.
Well, no, actually,
it doesn't necessarily have to be so today, though.
Yeah, the Boston Tea Party led to violence in as much as it led to the American Revolution. But that night, I mean, George Robert Twelvetree Hughes, who was there, the only guy who ever wrote a biography, an autobiography of what happened that night, he said that was the quietest night Boston had ever seen. When they did the Tea Party, they did it in complete silence. You know, people of Boston never even knew anything had happened until the next morning. And so it was not, you know, it was not like, you know, the black block trashing Seattle or something. I mean, it was a very different thing.
Well, I think we got to use the tools that we have here now.
But see, that was in opposition to a foreign corporation that was supported by a foreign government. And that's my point.
I think that's what we have here. Don't you agree with that?
No, I do not agree with that. We are Americans. We have this country. We own this country. I don't disagree that corporations, including foreign corporations, have way too much power and influence. So much so that you could make an argument, although not an absolute argument, that they have seized a disproportionate amount of control in our government. We still do some things right. We still do many things right, actually. But there, you know, you've got a lot of forces, the Cato Institute folk type, the whole libertarian thing that says, government shouldn't do anything. Let's turn it all over to the billionaires. Let the billionaires decide who goes to college. Let the billionaires decide who gets food stamps. Let the billionaires decide, how the public schools are run. Privatize everything. Government should not be doing any of these things. That was Ron Paul's shtick. It's like, of, by, and for the billionaires. I get that. But I think that the simple solution to it is to alter the Constitution, because the Supreme Court has invented out of whole cloth this doctrine, a very corrupt Supreme Court, by the way, in the 1880s. You had three members that were being bribed outright, Justice Stevens was the one in particular. Excuse me, Stephen Field was the one in particular who was being bribed to argue that corporations are people, as he was doing in the Ninth Circuit, and then kicking them up to himself in the Supreme Court. But this is a Supreme Court created doctrine. It's entirely possible that if the balance of power on the Supreme Court changes, that will change. And that, by the way, is the reason why right now you are having a filibuster battle in the United States Senate. The D.C. Circuit Court, the D.C. Court, is the court most likely from which presidents pick future candidates for the Supreme Court. They typically, when people move on to the Supreme Court, they are moved out of the D.C. Circuit Court. And that court has a number of empty seats in it. I think it has four. And right now it has a majority of Reagan and Bush appointees. It has a conservative majority. And that's the court that makes the final decision on things like labor laws, EPA laws, anything that has to do with the federal government. It's the most important court in America, second only to the Supreme Court. And Obama is nominating people for that court, and if he gets even one person on that court, he now has a majority. The Democrats have a majority, and the Republicans are willing to go to the mat to prevent that from happening. In fact, Chuck Grassley is saying, let's introduce legislation to reduce the number of members of the court so that it will be frozen with a conservative majority. I mean, this is how bizarre it gets. And the reason why is because they see the handwriting on the wall. It is entirely possible. If Obama can get some good progressives on the D.C. Circuit Court, and then as conservatives start moving off the U.S. Supreme Court, if Justice Thomas gets impeached, for example, because of his wife's behavior or his own behavior, or if Scalia gets impeached or leaves, or Kennedy or, any of those five were to leave that court for any reason, then the Supreme Court would change and we actually might be able to get our country back in part. I still think, though, that and Alan, thank you for the call, but I still think that the best solution, the straightforward solution, is to simply pass a constitutional amendment so the Supreme Court has no say in the matter.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
But it makes me crazy when people keep invoking the American Revolution as a model for now. We did not have our own government at that time. We overthrew an occupying foreign force. Welcome back, Tom Hartman, here with you 10 minutes before the hour. Diane in Lansing, Michigan. Hey, Diane, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I have an issue with your last guest that you had on. I happen to work at Michigan State University, and if we're a waste of time, then he might want to tell the 7,000 international students we have come in every year that.
Yeah, I agree. It's a damn good school.
We're also working on, right now, biofuel.
Mm-hmm.
We're investigating that.
Mm-hmm.
And where I work at Brody Square, we have what we call a pulper, and it takes all of our food waste and pulps it, and then they're looking into making that into fuel as well.
Oh, that is great. So you work near Brody Hall?
I actually work in Brody Hall. Yes.
Brody Hall, back in the 60s, had a radio station in the basement, and I think it was WBRD or something like that, Brody Hall Radio.
Yes.
And that was the first radio station I ever worked on.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, well, I worked there for a few months, made a tape, and then got a job at a, you know, WITL at a local radio station.
Yes, and Whittle is still in operation.
Yep.
Yep. And if you ever get a chance to come back to Michigan, you should check Brody out because they have remodeled the entire building.
Wow.
And it looks really great now.
Cool. I should. Diane, and thank you for the call, and thanks for sticking up for MSU. It's great to hear from you. John in San Francisco. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Well, a lot of things are on my mind, Tom, but thanks for taking my call. First of all, I personally feel that politicians should be accountable for what they say and also a conflict of interest. If, like, I believe it's Ron Paul, but I could be wrong, you know, if somebody's on the agriculture board in their state or their family is getting millions and millions of dollars,
mm-hmm.
conflict of interest. You know, that just can't be. I mean, we have to change our rules that our politicians live by, like the filibuster. Oh, I'm just going to filibuster, pretend like I'm going to filibuster and not actually do it. It's not acceptable. And mm-hmm. I know Harry Reid is trying to get that change, and good luck to him. But, you know, corporations are being above the law. Exxon, I believe it is, has a window that they don't get prosecuted with mm-hmm. anything. Monsanto having that 6-month window of opportunity to do basically poison America and not be held accountable for their actions is unreal. If anybody's above the law, no one should be above the law is how I should say it. And if they're as big as Bank of America is and with what Elizabeth Warren was trying to do, if you're that big, you need to be broken up. We have to enforce our laws, like you said. And the Neo guy from the Cato Institute, about his opinion about education and how it affected. Well, I lived in California, and I still do, when Reagan took office, and I saw the mess it created. And there's a real, and correct me if I'm wrong, Tom, isn't the government backing all student loans, guaranteeing those loans?
Not all of them, but yes, most of them. And in fact, the government's now issuing many of them. This is Barack Obama took $50 billion away from the banking industry. It used to be that you'd go to the banks to get a student loan. The banks would charge 7, 8, 9%, whatever they could get away with, and they were 100% guaranteed by the federal government, which was crazy. There was no risk to the banks, and they were still making this incredible profit that's supposed to represent the risk cost. And so Obama said, that's nuts. We'll just loan the money ourselves. And it cut $50 billion of profit out of the banking industry, and they are seriously PO'd about that. And, you know, this is what you're seeing, this whole, you know, anti-school, anti-education, anti-student loan, anti, you know, all this stuff is all part of that war by the billionaires and the banksters to get back the power to be the sole purveyors of student loans.
Well, anything that is backed by, anything that is guaranteed from us on our side, should be at a cost of, let's say, 2% above what it costs to get that money. So if the banks are getting the money at 0.25%, mm-hmm. you cannot lend it out at anything more than 2.25%. And if you really want to set up the economy to reinforce itself and make money off of it, you could have the government create CDs at the 2.25% to 2.5%, whatever the magic number would be. And our seniors would be able to buy those CDs for, let's say, a 5-year period at 2.25%, 2.5%. And they would be making more than 400% more than what they can get at the bank, if not 800% more than what it's at the local banks.
Yeah.
And that would feed the economy. That would feed our students to basically get the student loans at a fair, reasonable price. And our seniors and other elderly that need a good return on their savings would have a safe and secure asset.
That's an excellent suggestion, John.
Simple solution that wouldn't cost anything.
Yeah, no, it's an excellent suggestion. Thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing it. Bobby in Denver. Hey, Bobby, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going? I was going to ask you about the Internet service, but I was thinking I heard a comment by Bobby Kennedy Jr. on the Ring of Fire a few weeks ago, which I thought was just one of the greatest observations that I'd heard anyone make. It was soon after the bombing in Boston, and, you know, of course, that's a tragedy, you know, you got these coal companies that are blowing up the top of these mountains, and tons of nitroglyceride are washed down into our rivers and streams and poisoning thousands of miles of rivers and streams and giving people cancer. And he went on to say, you know, if terrorists came over and poisoned our rivers and streams and gave our people cancer, you know, America and the media would be up in arms, but the business are doing it. No one's saying anything about it. And I just thought that was such a great observation.
It is. That is an absolutely brilliant observation. Bobby, thanks for sharing that with us. Victoria in Columbia, Missouri. Hey, Victoria, what's up?
Hi, I wanted to respond to the gentleman you spoke with earlier about who had all the data on higher education.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in higher education, and I think it's a bit of a diversion to focus on the problem of student loans and the cost by just looking at student loans, because the real problem has been over the last 30 years the funding cuts on the state level to higher education. And there, you can go to any government website and find that information for different states. And sometimes you can find comparative information for it, as well as a really good Brookings Institute study that was done in 2003 that shows there'd be about $13 billion more in higher education from 1977 to 2003 if the states had continued funding at the same level.
Yeah, that was my original point to the guy from Cato, was that it used to be that students only paid 20% of the cost of going to college. Now they pay 80% of the cost of it. That's called tuition increase, because, or, you know, or the tuition's increase because, as you're correctly pointing out, state, federal, local government support has collapsed. Victoria, thank you for validating my point and for calling and sharing the information with us. We'll be right back. We're out of time here. We'll be right back with the second hour of our program.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to our second hour. You need to know this. We were warned 14 years ago. 14 years ago! That deregulating the big banks would crash the economy. When Congress passed the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act in 1999 and opened up commercial banks to the gambling houses on Wall Street by blowing away Glass-Steagall, very few people in Washington thought that was a bad idea. The Senate approved that by 90-8. The House approved it by 362-57. But there was one guy who did speak out quite loudly against deregulating the banks, against keeping gambling banks and commercial banks from operating, from being one entity. During the final Senate debate about Gramm-Leach-Bliley, North Dakota Senator Byron Dorgan pleaded with his colleagues to reconsider their yes votes, warning that repealing the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933, a New Deal-era law that kept Wall Street and Main Street banks separate, would open up our economy to a dangerous new level of risk. Check it out.
I worry very much that the fusing together of the idea of banking, which requires not just safety and soundness to be successful, but the perception of safety and soundness, but to merge it with inherently risky, speculative activity is, in my judgment, unwise. There are some notions that represent transcendental truths that are true over time. And one of those, in my judgment, I fervently believe, is that we are, with this piece of legislation, moving towards greater risk.
You think? That was 14 years ago about blowing up Glass-Steagall and letting basically, you know, the hustlers on Wall Street start hustling with your checkbook, with the money that you've deposited in the bank, your savings account, your mortgage money. Senator Dorgan also warned his fellow lawmakers that sometime in the near future they would regret their decision.
I think we will, in 10 years' time, look back and say we should not have done that because we forgot the lessons of the past.
Actually, it took 9 years. In 2008, Wall Street's gambling bubble collapsed and took the rest of our economy with it. And today, the major Wall Street banks are even bigger and even riskier than they were at the start of the financial crisis. And until we reimpose Glass-Steagall and separate banking from gambling, we will, as Senator Dorgan warned us, continue to repeat history over and over and over again. If we don't heed his advice, the next great crash will come along sooner than we think. And that's why it's time right now to repeal Phil and Wendy Graham's Financial Services Modernization Act of 1999 and go back to making banking boring. Period. Pigeon alert. We got a pigeon alert? Here's a pigeon alert.
Ghost chickens in the sky.
Ah, yes! Our pigeon alert music. Bird poo for beauty? Yes, this is the Mail Online, the UK paper, dailymail.co.uk. Bird poop for beauty, they say. That's what goes into facials at a luxury spa where the traditional Japanese treatment using imported Asian nightingale excrement mixed with rice bran goes for $180 a pop. Basically, they put bird poo on your face, and it's supposed to make the wrinkles and the pimples and everything go away. And everything wonderful. Well, in New York City, they're talking about doing this, but they're saying, you know, let's not use the pigeon stuff. Let's import from Japan the nightingale poo, because the pigeon stuff is dangerous. You think? I mean, these are robots, right? So, okay. Everybody knows they're spies and they're robots. You never see a baby pigeon. You never see a dead pigeon. They got to be spies from the planet Xenu here checking us out. Anyhow, anything goes summer here and anything goes Friday. Chris in Littleton, Colorado, listening on KKZ. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, how's it going, Tom? So I have some pretty close relatives that live in Toronto, and they were telling me that apparently Verizon Communications is trying to buy up to startup companies there that have about a 10% market share. Mm-hmm. And they're really worried that, you know, Verizon has 100 million some subscribers, you know, five times the size of Canada's entire population, that they're afraid that Canada is eventually, you know, I mean, the Verizon is going to monopolize because they're able to, you know, lower their prices so much by volume that, you know, they're going to wipe out the other three original Canadian companies, even though Verizon didn't contribute a cent to their infrastructure. I don't know if you've heard about this. It hasn't been talked about in the U.S. that I've seen.
I have not. Do you have a good source?
It was a New York Times blog, I guess, is what I, when I looked it up. I've actually been listening to a lot of Canadian talk radio, and I saw on the big picture you had mentioned that, you know, Canada has a variation of the fairness doctrine, and, you know, I've sort of tuned out to a lot, you know, except for you. I don't even listen to a lot of the conservative or liberal guys here in America. I mean, like, their topics range from, I think the other day, like, a baby almost drowned in, like, a local creek, and the big topic was, well, do your kids know how to swim? Do you know how to swim? You know? Right. And then there was another topic about, you know, are you a strict parent? Are you a permissive parent? And their topics aren't really that, like, volatile, like, drivel that you hear from Rush. Be afraid, be very afraid.
Right.
They have a little bit more, you know, engaging talk
well, that's,
radio.
That's more like, you know, when I was starting out in radio back in the late 60s, early 70s. Well, I mentioned Whittle, the first radio station I ever worked at, and I worked there for years and years. One of the owners was a guy named Chuck Drake, was his air name. His real name was Chuck Mefford. And he was just a wonderful and brilliant guy. And he was there were three guys who started this radio station from scratch. There was an engineer, a salesman, and a radio guy. And none of them were rich. You know, they had a little scratch between the three of them, but none of them were, you know, like from big families or anything. But they were willing to borrow some money and put, you know, scratch a few pennies together and build a radio station. And they started this thing from scratch. And that you could do that back in the day, you know. And Chuck, being the radio guy, they played mostly music. It was a country western station. But every afternoon from 3 to 4, he did a one-hour talk show. And he would just take calls from the local community. And I worked there then, and I occasionally produced his show. And that was the kind of stuff that local talk was all about. I mean, and it used to be that way all over the country. You'd have a few nationally syndicated shows, and you'd have, you know, a lot of locally, you know, locally done talk. And I think that that's a healthy thing, frankly.
And then another topic that they brought up, and I wanted to get your take on that, you know, they're saying that these corporations now, they call it, I think it's downsizing, that they're taking things like candy bars and containers of yogurt, and they're raising prices or keeping them the same, but yet they're making the serving size small, not like obviously a lot more color that you notice it, but you know, to the point where, you know, over time, then they're saying, well, people like to keep more food in their refrigerators and it, you know, frees up more space and that, you know, people prefer this. And
yeah, that's been going on for decades. You know, that's from the size of a soft drink, although soft drinks in some cases have actually gotten bigger, but mostly candy bars in particular, you see that where, you know, they used to be 10 ounces and then there were 9 ounces and then there were 8 ounces and now they're 3 ounces and, you know, and but the price was always the same, or the price started going up during times of inflation. And
right. Do you think this is a more of a marketing ploy that they're trying to?
It's a way of cranking up profits. It's a way of cranking up profits. You know, you reduce the product size until people start screaming, and then you stop. And you know, it's always. I mean, that's just a business thing. You know, what's the price point? What's the size point that is optimal in the marketplace? I don't. You know, other than the monopoly of the marketplace. You know, the one thing that allows that to happen is that the cost of entry into the candy marketplace right now is so high that there's basically 3 or 4 companies that own that marketplace. Thanks for the call.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And one of our callers today is going to get a free signed copy of Cracking the Code. Could be you. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, there's a couple of things that I wanted to bring up. Just first of all, just a kind of an FYI, just to keep you up to date. I know many of you were following over about a year ago, I guess, when my wife Louise was diagnosed with breast cancer and had surgery and chemo. And she went to the doctor this morning, and she has this... port installed. So for chemotherapy, it's actually under the skin, goes right into the heart so that you can inject the drugs right into that without ripping your arms apart. And the doctor said, let's schedule next Monday. Let's take the port out. You're done. You're clear. No sign of cancer. All is good. So, yeah, there you go. So good news. And but you know, please keep her in your prayers. And Higgins, our cat, went to the doctor yesterday. Louise took Higgins to the doctor, to the cat doctor, because he's been on this medication for a couple of weeks to find out if he had thyroid disease or kidney disease. And it looks like he has a little bit of both, but the thyroid disease seems to be caused by the kidney disease, and the kidney disease is not a good thing. And so, you know, Higgins, he doesn't have it severely, but it's eventually probably going to catch up with him. But, you know, Higgins is, I think, at least 15 years old. We got him when Justin was actually living in, I had said Georgia. He was living in Vermont when we got him. Louise corrected me. So that means it was back in the 90s. And probably 97, 98, something like that. So, and he was, you know, a kitten to a year old at that time. So he's 15 years old or thereabouts. So, and the other thing about Higgins is there was a time, and Louise is very clear about this because she's very careful about how she feeds her cats. There was a time when Higgins got really, really sick, and the other cats were kind of sick, but it really hit Higgins hard. And it was this mystery disease. We took him to the vet, and they couldn't find anything wrong with him. And, you know, it's like, you know, we don't know what's going on. His kidneys seem to have a problem, but it went away. And it was this mystery disease. And about a month after it went away, the story broke that there had been melamine, this poison that Chinese manufacturers of pet food that was sold into the United States and baby food that was sold in China, that they had put in because it simulates protein. When you measure protein levels in foods, it triggers the protein detectors, and it's very, very cheap. And it is what's called nephrotoxic, kidney toxic. It damages the kidneys. And Higgins's illness corresponded with the period of time when the melamine was in the food supply, and there was published a list of the kinds of cat food that had melamine, the brands, and the brand that Louise was feeding Higgins was one of those brands. And we don't know if we got one of the lots that contained the melamine or not. But I'm thinking that there's a very good chance that the reason my cat is sick right now is because of raw, unfettered libertarian capitalism. because some guy decided that he wanted to make a little extra money and put melamine in cat food in China, you know, some company, put melamine in the cat food, and they made a profit off it. And you know, my cat's sick as a result of it. And, of course, the way that a libertarian would respond to it, that is, oh, this is a perfect example of why we don't need regulation, because the market corrected itself. Once everybody discovered that their cats were being poisoned, the company stopped putting the stuff in the cat food. Well, that's true. But had there been oversight in the first place, had somebody been, you know, if there was the equivalent of a USDA for cat food, if there was an agency that was saying, is there poison in the cat food that's being sold in the country or dog food? Then, you know, my cat might not be sick and arguably dying right now. I don't think he's going to kick off tomorrow, but he is just skin and bones right now, and he's not the happiest thing. So we'll see how long he lasts. It might be months. It might be years. Who knows? But... And the other thing I wanted to talk about, I mentioned this and just riff about it a little bit, and if you want to talk about it, fine, and if not, and I see we've got, you know, a board full of calls on all kinds of other topics, too, for Anything Goes Friday here. But just something I've been rolling around in my head, and I wanted to share with you before the week was out. Yesterday, Ariel Castro was convicted of over 900 counts of rape and kidnapping and torture and just the horrific stuff that he did to these four women. These are three women, and then one of them had a daughter by him as a consequence of the rape and what he did to her as well. And I mean, imprisonment at the very least. And there's all this Sturm und Drang about he's a monster, you know, and I don't disagree with that, by the way, that he's a monster and these women are so resilient, and I don't disagree with that. I think that's all true. But nobody's mentioning what I think is the most important lesson to be taken out of all this. And I talked about this back when he was first arrested. And I keep waiting for the media to mention this. And I keep not hearing it. And it baffles me. And that is that the people in the neighborhood, they knew there was something funky going on in that house. In fact, the police have been called several times. But because... largely since the Reagan era, our police have become more and more militarized and more mobilized and more centralized. And we have done away with community policing. Now, Bill Clinton tried to bring it back. He put 100,000 cops on the street. And the idea was they wouldn't be driving around in patrol cars. They wouldn't be sitting in the patrol station. They wouldn't be part of a SWAT team. They would be the people walking the beat, the cop on the beat. This was a 10-year period. In my opinion, if they had community policing in that neighborhood in Cleveland, I believe it was, if they had community policing in that Cleveland neighborhood where every day or every other day there was a cop on the beat who got to know the people in the community, who knew that street, Ariel Castro would have been busted long before 10 years passed. We used to have community policing in the United States. And it's another thing that, you know, croaked as a consequence of these conservative domestic economic policies. And I think it's a shame. And why is there no discussion of that in the media? Could it be because there's no money in community policing? You can't make money selling turkey?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
You can't make money selling the turtle outfits, the Mutant Ninja Turtle outfits to these guys because they don't need all this heavy-duty equipment and tanks and things? I mean, is that why? Rand Paul and Tom Coburn, Republicans from Crazyville, have submitted legislation. Actually, Tom Coburn's from Oklahoma, Rand Paul's from Kentucky, and they both call themselves Tea Partiers. They have submitted legislation in the Senate, which three-quarters of all the Republicans in the Senate have put their name on, that would make it illegal for the government to pass child labor laws, minimum wage laws, workplace protection laws, worker safety laws. Workplace discrimination laws. All of those things go out the window. Labor is pure and simple the ability of a an employer to negotiate with an employee, period. The libertarians call this right to contract, and they say that's all it should be. So if you've got a loose labor market, if you've got a lot of people who are desperate and out of work, employers should be able to exploit them. They should be able to say, no, we're not going to put safety guards on that paper cutting machine. You might lose a finger. Tough luck. There's somebody behind you who wants a job. You can go home and we'll hire them. 13-year-olds, want to work for us? Cool. Drop out of school. Come on in. 10-year-olds, that's fine. Slap your employees around. They don't like it. Tough luck. Steal their paychecks? Sorry, federal government has no authority. Put a sign out that says, only white people allowed in this, you know, we only hire white people, for example. Hey, it's a right of contract, right? This is what Rand Paul and Tom Coburn, 36 senators, have introduced this bill. It's called the Enumerated Powers Act of 2013. It operates on the false premise that if it doesn't say it in the Constitution, if Congress is not given that power specifically to do something in the Constitution, they don't have that power. The Constitution does not say that Congress has the power to create a federal air traffic control system. Might be because there weren't airplanes in 1789, but nonetheless, it doesn't say that. And so the only people allowed to run a federal air traffic or a national air traffic control system should be billionaires and large corporations. I mean, you know, this makes perfect sense, doesn't it? And when they do, they should be free of government interference. We don't need those stinking safety regulations. This libertarian strains creeping across America. But anyhow, I've been ranting way too much for an Anything Goes Friday. Let's pick up your calls. We've got a board full of calls here. Jack in Albuquerque. Hey, Jack, what's up?
Yeah, and Tom, thanks for taking my call. I've been waiting so long, my ire has cooled about the Cato.
Yeah, 55 minutes. I'm sorry about that, Jack. What's up?
All right. But I do feel that I have to make a comment. What he was talking about, and I think he was demeaning the need for college student loans or support for a college student to go to school. And I really think it's even more important to have a college education. I'm 78 years old, and when I my parents, all they had to know is a little bit about farming and how to spell and general mathematics, you know, to make a sales slip and make change.
Right.
Now it's far more complicated, you know, the digital sciences, the nuclear sciences, the medical sciences, all require much more skilled education and and I just think I just kind of resented the attitude of that we are just necessarily borrowing money for a higher education.
Yeah. What I find so bizarre is the argument that the government should not be in the student loan business because if students need loans, that's something the private industry should provide. The banksters should provide it. And it completely overlooks the larger picture, the bigger picture, which is that nobody should really be in the student loan business because there shouldn't be a need for them. We should be like all the other developed countries in the world. We should let our students, we should send our students, if they are capable of college and want to go to college, it should be free. In fact, you know, we should do like Denmark and give them a stipend or like we did with the GI Bill. My dad got $100 a month to go to college.
Yeah. Well, I agree. And I think, again, you know, the importance of education, like I say, is even more important now than ever. And I think the skills to even get a wage that's a living wage now. You need.
I agree. And not only that, even if somebody has a degree in American literature or philosophy, you learn things. It's a socializing experience. It's an educational experience. It's a critical thinking experience. It broadens your worldview. It expands the, you know, you become a better citizen. You become a more knowledgeable person. by going to college. And if you're not a person who can go to college or who wants to go to college, that's fine. And I, you know, I honor that. And let's build some trade schools. But the problem is that we don't have trades in the United States anymore because all those jobs have been shipped overseas. So, you know, we need to bring manufacturing back so that we can have schools, trade schools, where people can go and learn to be machinists. Or let's go back to the way it was. You know, my dad, as I've mentioned a million times, you know, my dad worked in a tool and die shop for 40 years, and they would train people. I mean, one of my brothers actually, worked there for a year or so, decided it wasn't for him and went on to something else, but he actually became an electrician. But, you go in there and you start out as an apprentice, and you spend, I think it was like 4 years to become a journeyman tool and die maker. And it was the union that did that. The union worked you through that, you know, the machinists union. And it was an on-the-job training program, and you got paid while you were learning. But it was, I mean, you know, let's go back to that. But you've got to first have manufacturing in order to make it happen. Jack, excellent point, and thanks for listening to KABQ. Brian, in DeKalb, Illinois, listening on WCPT. Hey, Brian, what's up?
Yeah, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
Oh, yeah. I just had a I love your theory on the pigeons. It's just I get a laugh every time.
But they are spies from the planet Xenu sent here to keep an eye on us, and that's why you don't see dead or baby pigeons. But you say you've seen dead and baby pigeons?
Oh, buddy, I'll tell you what. You go in Chicago and you get some of those bad places where you got to go, and yeah, buddy. I'm sorry to say, but yeah, there's little babies and dead ones too. So
Brian, respectfully, yes. I hate to burst your bubble. Those are actually dead and baby doves that are cleverly painted by the spy robots from the planet Xenu.
Oh, damn, they're pretty damn good, ain't they?
I'm telling you, they got us figured out. Brian, thanks a lot for the call. I believe you. John in Prescott, Arizona, you've got a pigeon story?
Hey, Tom.
Hey, John. You are on the air, sir.
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah, I had an odd pigeon story this morning.
Okay.
I drive up to my shop to go to work, and I come up to the people door and unlock it, and there's a pigeon on the ground, not moving.
Uh-huh.
So I go over, and it starts waddling away, and it's dragging both its wings.
Uh-huh.
So I'm thinking, what do I do with this pigeon?
Right.
Well, I end up putting it in a box, trying to give it some water, and I finally called the local vet, which is only a few blocks away, and they said, well, why don't you just keep it and feed it? And I said, well, what am I going to do with a pigeon? So they said, well, call the zoo. It's about 15 minutes from here. So I called the zoo, got a hold of the guy, and they actually took this poor thing. So I drove it out there and dropped this pigeon off, and it had, I don't know what they're going to do with it, but it had two broken wings. And
I can tell you what they're going to do with it. They're going to feed it to the eagle.
Pigeon on the ground. Maybe it was faking just to try and get me to take it to the zoo or something.
We've got to figure out a conspiracy theory here for that. But well, I know what it was. Obviously, the robotic pigeons from the planet Xenu. Yeah, they were faking it so that you would call into the talk show and reassure them, you know, the world that the pigeons aren't actually robots. Probably the zoo is using them. They do take small birds and animals and things and wounded ones, and they use them as food for their eagles.
Oh, that's better than just throwing it in the garbage or something.
I agree.
I just couldn't stand to see the poor thing suffer.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it'll get recycled in the way that when eagles kill prey, apparently prey goes into a shock response really, really fast, and so they don't suffer a lot, at least from my understanding. Anyhow, John, thanks for sharing that story. That's a great one. From John to John in Canyonville, Oregon. We got a minute to the break. John, you want to talk about free trade?
Well, yeah, I just was wondering, every time I have a conversation with some friends of mine about, you go through this explanation all the time about Reagan, started with Reaganomics and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Anyway, but then one time I heard you talking about how it actually started with Jimmy Carter, opened up the free trade, and then...
Well, it really started with Nixon.
Nixon
opened, you know, tried to open America to China. He was heavily bankrolled by Pepsi Cola, and they wanted to sell their products in China. And so he came up with this idea of I always mix up my terms. There's permanent and normal trade relations, and there's most favored nation status. And one of those was Nixon's, and one of those was Reagan's, and I forget which was which. But he came up with one.
The point that
I'd
like to make is, it seems like we always have some good intentioned bill or legislation that later on gets sullied or somehow.
Well, it was a scam from the get-go. I mean, this was an attempt by a soft drink company to break into a marketplace, which you can understand and why, you know, they'd want to invest in a politician to do that. That's how business works in America, tragically. But it really picked up steam under Reagan, and it came into full fruit with Clinton, with NAFTA, SHAFTA, CAFTA, all that stuff.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And the biggest one, of course, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trades, GATT, which produced the World Trade Organization, the WTO. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com, on the line with us, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's going on in the world today?
Well, lots of things. First of all, the economy added 162,000 jobs in July, according to the data from the government released this morning, which is considered not as good as had been hoped for or predicted. They were predicting about 20,000 more jobs. Also, estimates for May and June were revised down by a total of 26,000 jobs. The jobless rate fell from 7.6 to 7.4%. Part of the decline was due to workers dropping out of the labor force. So it was considered not a strong labor report. However, the White House was fairly enthusiastic about it, saying the recovery was entering its fifth year and we need to build on the progress we've made, and that the employment report provides further confirmation that the U.S. economy is continuing to recover, and also saying that what we need to do is to not impose self-inflicted wounds and that the sequester is a drag on the economy and needs to be gone.
It is very true. I mean, let us not forget, and, you know, I guarantee you there are right-wing talk radio shows all over this country. You are probably on many of them doing your news reports that are going off about how bad the economy is, how bad unemployment is, how, you know, how workers aren't getting, you know, what they deserve, blah, 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 blah. And when conservatives and Republicans say those things, they are bragging. Back to you.
The State Department today issued a worldwide travel alert because of an unspecified al-Qaeda threat, particularly in the Middle East and North Africa, and possibly occurring in or emanating from the Arabian Peninsula. Nevertheless, this is a worldwide travel alert that expires on August the 31st, so it applies to all American citizens. You can get all the details from the State Department website. So if you are traveling, there are very specific things that they suggest that you do. They have a free smart traveler app, but they do suggest that you register with the nearest consulate or embassy, and they also suggest that you be very aware of your surroundings. They warn you about the kind of places where al-Qaeda has targeted in the past, and it's a very serious threat for a very credible, what they believe is very credible.
Do you think this has anything to do with the prison break in Iraq, where 200 of the quote, worst, end quote, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula guys made a prison break?
I think that's a possibility. I think the anniversary of Benghazi is a possibility. And I think coming up towards the end of Ramadan is a possibility. And I think the number of strikes that the U.S. has had by drones in Yemen this year is a possibility. Because, as you know, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula is based in Yemen.
Right. Yeah,
all that stuff makes sense. All those things are possibilities.
Yeah. Thank you.
The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, today reversed its previous decision and approved additional funding to help rebuild the small Texas town of West, where an April fertilizer plant exploded, leveled homes, damaged buildings, and killed 15 people.
Has anybody been held to account for that? Has anybody gone to prison for murder?
No, they are still investigating this.
I see.
They still don't know exactly what happened.
But they do know that the company that was running that was storing thousands of pounds of high explosives there without a permit illegally.
Correct.
Isn't that enough to at least arrest somebody?
Apparently not.
Yeah, well, of course, it's corporate malfeasance. Okay.
Apparently not.
Yeah.
The House voted 232 to 185 today to block the IRS from enforcing Obamacare. Four Democrats supported the bill, along with every Republican. This is really a revenge bill. It's the 40th vote to repeal Obamacare, and it's a in-your-face IRS bill. It's also another one of the stop government abuse bills that they're voting for this week. There was some pretty heated rhetoric on the House floor this week today about this bill. As Republicans accuse the Democrats of locking them out of the process of writing the bill in the first place, going back to 2010. So I think there's a bit of grudge holding. The IRS is out of control, abusing its power. And Sandy Levin from Michigan, the ranking member on the Ways and Means Committee, a Democrat, saying the bill is a continuation of the Republicans' blind obsession with repealing the law, also saying, this should be said categorically, neither the IRS or the Department of Health and Human Services will have access to medical records or other personal history, no access whatsoever. Because that's something that is being put about, which is that the IRS is going to have access to, you know, whether you've ever had zits or, you know.
Or seen a shrink, for that matter. Yeah. And it's, you know, things that might be embarrassing or had an abortion or had, you know, a sexually transmitted disease. And in fact, and that's the stuff that, you know, again, the right wing talk show hosts, I've heard several of them going off on this stuff, and it's just not the case. And beyond that, you know, I was up on the Hill today and I heard some of these speeches. We were sitting in the House recording studio. And just watching it on the monitor, and it was bizarre. It's absolutely bizarre. And then and then Barbara Lee, I don't know if you saw Barbara Lee, she got up and she said, why aren't we talking about real stuff? You know, why aren't we, like, putting people back to work? And
what
was that? Yeah, she was largely ignored by the Republicans. So anyhow, 30 seconds, Victoria, anything else?
Final Friday story, Noah said today that Puget Sound killer whales will remain protected under the Endangered Species Act.
Is that good?
It's a good thing because there was a petition to take them off the Endangered Species Act. Yes.
A petition by what? The oil companies want to drill there?
California farmers who face water restrictions to protect salmon that the orcas eat.
Yeah. Well, somebody who was making a buck. Yeah. Okay, I get it. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
And have a wonderful weekend.
You too.
Thank you. We'll be right back with Mark Williams, conservative commentator, former president of the Tea Party Express, to talk about Detroit.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. And Mark Williams joins me. He's conservative commentator, former president of the Tea Party Express. His website and talk show host, his website, marktalk.com, marktalk.com. Hey, Mark.
Hey, how are you doing, Tom?
Good.
Been a while.
Welcome back, indeed. This Detroit situation... You sent us either a link or the article itself to this openmarket.org piece about how the Detroit bankruptcy in part was a consequence of their pensions being in trouble and how pensions all over America are in trouble. You want to elucidate on that?
Yeah. In fact, I live in California, which when it finally does go down, it will be the pensions. What's happened is I hate to use the trite phrase like kick the can, but we've gotten to the end of that particular road. Today, and the problem here is not the pensioners. The problem is politicians and union leaders and others corporate folks who back in the day figured that they would say and promise whatever it is they chose to say and promise, and eventually somebody else would have to pay for it somewhere down the generational line.
Wait a minute, Mark. You know that's not the case. The problem is that the pension actuarials, the people who calculate the assumed rate of return on pension investments, because, first of all, it's defined terms. There's two ways that you can save for retirement. One is a defined investment. What is it called?
Defined payment or something.
Yeah, defined payment, whatever. It's a 401k where...
You're going to get 10 bucks no matter how the...
That's right. You got $100,000 in the bank. When your $100,000 is gone, even if you live another 10 years, you are just flat out of luck, Charlie. And the other is a pension where you get that, you get a fixed and predictable amount of money for the rest of your life. Social Security is a pension, basically. And pension plans were widespread in the United States until Reagan came along with his idea of, back then they called them individual retirement accounts, IRAs, and then, 401ks became popular under the Bush administration, the first Bush administration. Where it's just, you have what you have. But we had pensions. I mean, from the 30s, pensions started becoming very popular in the 30s and 40s as a bargaining chip among employers as an added benefit for people. And they worked fine in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and early 80s.
The bill hadn't come due yet. I mean,
well, no, the bill came due a lot of times through that time. It's just that they were doing their math based on the assumption of 7% returns on their investments.
But they weren't funding these things. That's the problem.
Oh, they were.
Especially the public sector. They weren't funding these pension plans. They were using the money, diverting it for other things, and saying, don't worry about it. Somebody down the road will have to pay.
Well, there were some corporations.
That's what happens here in California. We are, nobody knows how many billions and billions of dollars in the hole we are, because for every dollar they promised somebody, they kicked in a couple of pennies.
But the problem is what's called the discount rate. And the discount rate is, what you assume you're going to make as a return on your investment, and then you calculate that against the probability of how many people are going to survive how many years. And historically, which is basically the return on investment assumption. And historically, these pensions have been assuming a return on investment of 7 or 8%. And that worked fine in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and even the first half of the 80s. And then Reaganomics kicked in, and for the last 30 years, return on investment has not been what it used to be. And you combine that with the trillions of dollars worth of equity that was wiped out by the great Bush crash, and you've got pensions which have invested their money, and they're not getting those rate of returns. In fact, the article you sent me says if all these pensions just calculated with a 5% assumption of return on investments, everything would be fine. But they're continuing to use these 7 and 8% numbers, these pre-Reaganomic numbers. And, Reaganomics has just devastated the middle class, and it's also devastated the ability of a pension to get a decent rate of return.
We also, with a stated benefit, we remove the incentive that the pensioner has while they're still working to monitor that investment and monitor that rate of return.
Exactly.
No matter what happens to that fund,
exactly,
they're going to get X number of dollars.
Which I think most people think is a really good thing.
Depending on how well that fund performs, they're going to be a whole lot more vigilant, and they're going to be a whole lot less low information.
But see, I think that's a good thing. Why do you think that we should say to 115 million American workers, not only do you have to do your job all day and raise your family and parent your kids and wife your husband or husband your wife and all the other responsibilities, plus you have to become an expert in investments. You have to manage your own 401k. That's crazy. I like the idea. I don't have a pension. I wish I did. I like the idea of being able to say to an organization that has professional investors, here, I'll cut a deal with you. You guarantee me that on the day I retire, I get $2,000 a month for the rest of my life, and I'll give you this money right now, and you are committed to that, so you're going to have to meet those investment goals.
Well,
I don't want to become an investment expert. I don't want to be diligent.
The guys who make the promise aren't the ones who have to pay it. It's the generations to come. It's you. It's
no,
me. It's our kids.
No.
It's our grandchildren.
People with pensions paid for it every single day of their lives.
$1,000 of debt before they take the first breath.
My dad had a pension. He worked 40 years in a tool and die shop, and when he retired, he had a pension, which he kept until the day he died. And in fact, it rolled over to my mom until she died. And it worked just fine. I mean,
Sure. Well, my dad's got one from the paper mill he worked in. I mean, the other,
right. So why should these people have had to become investment experts back in their 30s when they were trying to raise their families?
It's not a matter of being an expert in investments.
Well, it's what you just said. You said people should be diligent about their investments. I think that's crazy.
Do you not double check? You know, if your mechanic tells you you've got X expensive thing wrong, do you not double check?
I don't know how to.
You're not an expert, but you're paying attention.
If my mechanic tells me that the piston rings in my car are bad, I'm not going to rip the engine block apart and double check.
No, but you're going to ask somebody else to check it out.
No, I'm not.
If you go to a doctor and a doctor says you need your spleen out, I don't think you're going to stop there. I think maybe you're going to go to another doctor who might have a different opinion about your spleen. It's simply about being situationally aware. We are in a post-literate society. People don't know how to think critically. People don't know how to evaluate. It's getting worse.
People are overloaded, Mark. Reaganomics has doubled the workload of the middle class. We used to have, what it used to be before Reagan, one person could raise, you know, more than half of American working families. One person could raise, you know, could fully fund the family. Now the average income, you know, it used to be that the average individual wage and the average household wage were within 10 or 15% of each other. Now the average household wage is $44,000 a year, but the average income wage is $25,000 a year. That's almost, you know, almost two full-time jobs in the average family in America. And you're asking those people to also become investment advisors?
We've regulated the jobs into the third world. And what we're left here with is service jobs, repairing and servicing the products that come from the third world.
I know. And I, you know, when I hear Republicans and conservatives say that, I get it. You guys are bragging about what you did to the working class.
No, not at all. I mean, I'll be one of the first people to tell you that. Far be it for me to defend anything from the Roosevelt political bloodline, but, you know, Teddy Roosevelt's progressive trust busting and, you know, FDIC, which was destroyed in the Clinton administration, all that stuff, that was good, that was reasonable. You know, saying that you can't dump cyanide into a reservoir, that's reasonable. But we've gotten to a point now where, in fact, I've got a family member involved in doing this, where companies that are trying to get startup money here to produce good jobs can't deal with the regulation. They find themselves going offshore.
Tell me one regulation.
My brother-in-law who's making himself.
Tell me one regulation.
You're recruiting those people to
tell me one regulation that you would like to do away with that would help us have jobs. Because usually when people say that, they're speaking on behalf of the Koch brothers and they want Koch Industries to be able to dump more stuff in the air and water. Tell me one regulation.
The Constitution.
One regulation, Mark. Name it. I may agree with you. One regulation you want to get rid of.
I'll tell you what, let's pick one of the several hundred thousand pages of regulations to any one.
One regulation.
Okay, my backyard, because it gets wet 3 months a year, is not a vernal pool. It's not a wetland, but try to tell that to the EPA.
Okay. All right. You know, thank you. Mark Williams. Hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Mark Williams, marktalk.com. You can read all about it. Mark likes wetlands, or doesn't like wetlands, or one or the other, right, Mark?
Right.
Okay. Thank you, Mark. Past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. So, I would love to see us return to pensions. And, yeah, I get it. You know, 30 years of Reaganomics has reduced the return on investment that most pension funds have. So, we should... See, this is actually an argument for government regulation. Because although pension funds are regulated, they have not been down-regulated in terms of the expectation of return that they can get. And part of that is that, you know, we had the roaring 2000s, the first 6 years of the Bush administration. It wasn't so roaring, but, you know, the stock market, actually the roaring 90s, and the stock market continued to climb for almost a 20-year period. We had this, you know, this bubble, the bank deregulation, Alan Greenspan pump and cheap money bubble. And that bubble produced good returns on investment for pension funds. And then you had the Republican Great Crash in 2007, 2008, and that bubble burst, and now you got a bunch of pension funds that are left holding an empty bag, and they owe money to the pensioners. And Detroit is one example of it. Mark is absolutely right in that regard. Where he's wrong is that this is like, you know, people expecting future generations to pay and all that kind of quack stuff. Actually, I shouldn't name Mark because he's not here to defend himself, and he might disagree with that. But I would say those who assert that this is all about, you know, I want mine now and let the future pay for it, that's not the case. People who have pensions because they paid into them, and the amount that they get out is a direct function of the amount that they paid in, period. You can't just join a pension 1 year into it, pay $1,000 into it, and then say, hey, give me $1,000 a month for the rest of my life. It doesn't work that way. I've looked into them. It just doesn't work that way. Detroit Johnny O. Hey, Detroit. Hey, in Romulus, Michigan. Hey, Detroit Johnny, how you doing?
Mr. Hartman, how are you today?
Very well, thank you. What's up?
That's good. You know, I was just concerned about Mr. Snowden. You know, the Russians said he could stay there now. You know what? What's the, you know, who's watching his back? Has anybody got his back? Is he all by himself over there?
I am guessing, you know, he had the WikiLeaks lawyer with him, and I'm guessing that he's probably got some people with him he can trust. But I have no idea, frankly.
Yeah, either do I. That's what I'm worried about, because, yeah, you know, Don, well, if he was over here, we wouldn't have nobody helping him here either.
Yeah.
And but the Russians could slip him a Mickey and put him on a plane, and he'd be here.
Yeah, yeah. Anything is possible. Anything is possible. So, anyhow, is that what you called about, Johnny?
That was the main reason, but, and that Zimmerman guy, you know what's going to happen to him, don't you? They're not going to find him. He's going to turn out like Hoffa.
I don't think so.
It may take some time, but you know what? Somebody's going to do something crazy.
Yeah. Well, I sure hope not. I mean, you know, it's as much as I, and thanks for the call, Johnny, as much as I disagree with the verdict, I more strongly disagree with vigilante justice. Mark in Chicago. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hi. Hey, wasn't Zimmerman arrested like only six weeks after the event?
Yes.
So that would be enough time to heal almost any wounds, actually.
Yeah.
So anyway, I mean, that would explain that. But
but you know, the point that the earlier caller was making was that Trayvon Martin had none of George Zimmerman's DNA on him, none of George Zimmerman's blood on him, and yet George Zimmerman was alleging that.
Blood either, right? Excuse me, because if he was shooting up, you know, like he said he was, he would have had it on his shirt and all that. He would have had Trayvon Martin's blood on his shirt.
Oh well, he went home and you know, as far as I know, I mean, I don't know. I shouldn't speak to it. So I. Anyhow, is that what you called about?
That's what I called about.
Okay.
Did I hear you say that the United States does not engage in empire?
No. The caller called. This is a growing conspiracy theory, and I don't mean that in a way to demean it, but I don't know how else to describe it. That at the founding of this of the United States, that what happened was we didn't start a country, we started a corporation. And that if your name is typed in all capital letters on your birth certificate, you are the property of the corporation or some variation on that. And that the original idea at the founding was to have a corporation that would one day rule the world, that was an empire, and that the establishment of the United States was for empire. And I said, no, I don't think in the days of George Washington that they were thinking of establishing an empire. In fact, they had just disassociated themselves from the British Empire, and I think empire was the last thing on their minds. If anything, they thought it was a pretty damn bad idea.
Some people say the Monroe Doctrine was like an assertion of imperial.
I would not disagree with that, but you know, James Monroe was president in the 1820s. I mean, that was long after George Washington and all the other founders were dead, many of them were dead. I mean, America changed an awful lot between the 1880s and the 1780s and the 1820s.
Right. So anyway, okay. All right.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call. I do think that, you know, there were politicians at that time who were thinking empire, not a bad idea. Carson in Orange, California. But I don't think that we're a giant corporation. Carson in Orange, California. What's on your mind today?
Oh, love to love you.
Thank you. What's up?
Hey, I just want to, first of all, I need to know, is there a Tom Hartman action figure? What would it be holding if there was, and where can I find it?
I think you know the answer. No, there's not, and I have no idea what it would be holding. Maybe a book. Probably a book.
Okay. I dig the books, and actually I'm working on a young adult novel. I really think that we need to help our next generation identify, you know, the good side of whether or not you're Republican or Democrat. Mm-hmm. But the best I've got so far is that Republicans think that money is the best way to help people, whereas on the left just kind of think that people are more important than money. I was wondering if you could help me with that.
Well, I think that's one of the great divides is that Democrats think that government, progressives, liberals, whatever, think that government can play an active role in improving the quality of people's lives. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why we create government. It's why we create community. It's why we create cities. It's why we have family and clan and tribe and all those things, that it's for the good of the person, all the individuals in the community, but for the good of the community. Whereas the conservative worldview is that if every individual acts as a sociopath and pursues only their own self-interest, and the quantifier of it is typically money, that will somehow magically produce a paradise. And it's never been proven to work. In fact, if anything, every time it's been tried, it's failed. But they still hold to that philosophy. Carson, good luck with your book. I wish you well. One writer to another. Good luck. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And the best piece of advice I ever got about writing a book is that if you're a writer, you write. Write every day. Write. 28 minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you in the place where despair is not an option. Tom Hartman Program. We've got lots of good solutions. We've got a resilient nation. We have been to hell and back. We've been through a civil war. We've been through a Great Depression. Two of them, really. We've been through world wars. We've been through Republican presidents. I mean, you know, this country has been knocked down so many times, and we keep coming back. We're going to come back again. I mean, we're in the process of it, I think. So, Lawrence in Berkeley, California. Hey, Lawrence, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Prescription against despair.
Indeed.
I heard Bernie Sanders yesterday talking about Republicans destroying the minimum wage and cutting Social Security and education and health and all that,
mm-hmm.
and how it's extremely unpopular with the voters, which is all true. But the thing is that we don't need to hear that anymore, at least anybody on your show. We know that. Mm-hmm. What we need to know about is how to get rid of them.
That involves two steps. You've got an election coming up in 2014, and one is to engage yourself in local politics or statewide politics, because that's where the House of Representatives, they come out of your, well, it's not a statewide vote, but it's a district, congressional district vote. And, you know, getting involved, yeah. If that means joining the Democratic Party or joining some group that is working to elect somebody who is electable and is at the very least a Democrat and ideally a good progressive, doing that, number one. And number two, finding local movements that are pushing politicians, pushing the entire political process and pushing the zeitgeist, you know, the spirit of the times, a fancy German word for spirit of the times, pushing that in a more progressive direction, whether that's your local Move On group or your local Move to Amend.org group or your local, Democracy for America group. I mean, there's a bunch of organizations that do have local groups, local meetings. Mm-hmm. Could be, you know, joining the United Church of Christ or the Unitarian Universalists. They're fairly politically active. There's lots and lots of venues. You can find one that matches your temperament and beliefs where you can become an activist. The local Occupy group, of course.
Tom?
So, yes, sir.
Can I end of rant.
Yes, your turn.
Specific suggestion.
Yes, sir.
Is that what we need right now is a coalition that will register people, especially we'll go into poor neighborhoods and minority neighborhoods, and register up a storm between now and the elections in November 14. And we no longer have ACORN. You know, mm-hmm. our dear president didn't speak up for them when they were being lied against. So the progressive organizations in this country need to create a coalition which will be a super ACORN, an ACORN times 10 or 20, that will go and register everybody. And what they need to do in addition to that is the people that they register and the people that they approach who are who are already registered need to be connected to a progressive group, a local progressive group, so that they will be sure to vote, you know, at that time. And I'm hoping that this will be mostly a progressive coalition rather than a Democratic coalition. What I've seen in Northern California is the Democratic Party is really not very interested in registering a lot of poor people. And I can tell you, you know, why I think that. So I'm hoping that all of the, you know, for instance, there's going to be in Madison, Wisconsin, in a couple of days, there's going to be a Democracy Coalition. That would be a great opportunity, a Democracy National Meeting,
mm-hmm.
great opportunity for them to form this kind of coalition for registration and voting.
Mm-hmm. I would suggest, Lawrence, that you start one. Start one in Berkeley.
Oh my! I've got,
get some people together. Know. Say, hey, let's do this. You know, or
okay. Where I live in Berkeley, we get about 7% of the voters vote Republican. Literally 7%. Yeah. So it wouldn't do a lot of good.
But see, you can do a lot of good. I mean, there are people who do that by basically phone banking. I mean, you know, if you have some unlimited minutes on your phone or something like that, you know, it's you can make calls. I mean, there's a variety of ways to participate that don't even involve leaving your house if you prefer not to.
This is true, but I wanted to ask you a larger and more general favor, as it were, and that is, you know, as I say, we already know, you know, who done it. And who's hurting from it? What we mostly need to know is how to organize, how to be an activist, specifically how to go about that, and then talk about the methods, the techniques, strategies. And I wish that you could devote, say, an hour a week to your show specifically for activists to call up and say, this is how we're doing it. This is how we're organizing this, and get people talking about that.
You know, we did a lot of very specific programming, like what you're describing, before the 2012 election about how to become a precinct committee person. And, you know, and this is something that the Tea Party was doing really aggressively in 2010. And it took me a year to figure out that they were up to it. But the Concord Coalition, as I recall, has videos on their website, and they've got videos on YouTube. And if you Google precinct committee chairperson, or you go to YouTube and plug it into their search engine, or Concord Coalition, I'm pretty sure that that's the name of it, you will see these videos that tell Tea Partiers how to take over the local Republican Party. And they're brilliant. And we played them on the air, and we talked about that at length. And you're right. We should do that again. And so thank you for that encouragement. And I will have that conversation with Sean and Louise. And if anybody is out there doing this kind of stuff on the ground and you want to discuss it or share things, you know, please drop by TomHartmann.com. Put your information on in the comments on the blog on the front page, which I do read. And, you know, we'll take it and run with it. Lawrence, thanks for the call. Great suggestion. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John. Social Security?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that, you know, Social Security was a compromise between groups in this country, between the Roosevelt administration and conservatives. And what they came up with is something that would prevent people from starving in their old age. And that's exactly what people did, you know, before that. And, you know, instead of having a national pension plan, and that's what the Roosevelt administration wanted, we ended up with pensions that are tied to employment, and it's just like health care. You know, health care, pensions, education, they should all be a right. In an industrialized country, we're all producing the wealth that creates this country, and we deserve to be taken care of in our old age and when we're sick. And it all benefits us that people are educated, and this is exactly how it's done throughout the rest of the industrialized world, and that's all I wanted to say.
Well, you said it brilliantly, John, and you're absolutely right. And if you go back and you look at Franklin Roosevelt's second Bill of Rights proposal, which he laid out the year before he died, that's what he said. He said, we need a new Bill of Rights. We need to carve into the Constitution or carve into legislation that people have a right to health care, they have a right to housing, they have a right to a job. And if the, and if capitalism fails and can't provide that job, government will. They have a right to housing, and they, all of these things, that there, there is a basic minimum floor, and you're right, that most of the developed world has that second Bill of Rights as part of their social contract, and as part of their law, and we don't, and we should. Norman in Cedar Lake, Indiana. Hey, Norman, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Great pleasure to talk with you, and praise God for Louise's victory over cancer.
Well, thank you.
In America, we have Obamacare now, and if we compare what's going on in America to Canada or the United Kingdom, where they have the one-payer system, you'll find that there's many additives that put into our food, like bromide to stabilize bread where it used to be iodine, and any enriched flour, pasta, et cetera, is enriched with bromate or bromide, which is a halide metal like fluoride, iodine, and chloride. Well, our thyroid gland needs iodine in order to produce the four hormones that it does that all of our organs in our body needs, our brain, liver, skin, everything. And these other things, especially bromide in bread and so many other products, plug those receptors, and your thyroid can't use them, in which case then people are getting hypothyroidism. Hmm. I have it. My wife has it. My wife, by changing her diet and going to, like, Petrich Farm bread, and other unbromided and products that are not made with enriched flour, has actually cured herself of hypothyroidism.
Wow.
And in this country, they always think that everybody doesn't have that problem because there's so much iodine and everything. But this bromide and these other, like fluoride, they actually plug the receptors, and your thyroid cannot do that. Now, once the we get to a one-payer system here on our health care, we're going to start to see laws implemented here to prevent those bad additives from being put into food.
Right, because right now we have a reverse incentive. Right now, when people get sick because the food is poisonous, then you've got another industry that makes a profit off their getting sick. But if that cost was borne by all of us, then we would collectively say, hey, let's stop making ourselves sick.
Exactly. That's exactly what's going on. And so I've been for the last year now tracking everything that's going on in the FDA. I get the emails every day, and I've been comparing many, many things to what's going on here in the United Kingdom, all across the world for that matter. We allow things in our foods here that in many countries, in fact, some of them, even 119 countries, it's illegal, and it's even criminal. You can go to jail for it.
Yep, you're absolutely right. Norman, thank you for the call. Excellent point. And another good argument for a national health care system, for, you know, Bernie Sanders' argument that we need a good single-payer system. I mentioned I interviewed John Conyers this morning. We'll be playing that parts of that next week. And he's got House Resolution 676, Medicare for All, once again.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
John Conyers is also promoting House Resolution 1000, which is a jobs bill. Gee, what a novel idea. Republicans won't consider it. Welcome back. Thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, our writer-researcher, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldbook for video productions, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to all the folks at the different companies and organizations that syndicate this program, Dow Global on the commercial side, Pacifica Radio on the non-commercial side, SiriusXM Satellite Radio, CRN Network, Free Speech TV, on Dish Network, DirecTV, all the cable providers who carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the others around the country, all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, our TV show, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room, to Alan Ratner, Victoria Jones, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jake Goodman-Tamboli for tech support, and to our affiliates, our sponsors, and you, for supporting our program. And it means a lot when you, if you listen to a particular radio station or watch a particular TV station and you let them know that you like the show, it really, really does make a big difference. Or you hear a particular underwriter or sponsor, if you're particularly if you're listening on commercial radio, call and let them know that you heard about them on this program. That does mean a lot. It's what keeps us going. Siri in Blountsville, Alabama. Am I saying that right, Siri?
Yes, Tom, how are you today?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you?
I hope this country gets better.
I agree.
Listen, I've been taking care of an elderly lady that has had stage 3 lung cancer. This is the third time.
Oh, my.
Now, they've been at, I live in Alabama, a Republican state, and this is, Viva Medicare has cut out her rides to her doctors. All the elderly cannot get rides to the doctors anymore. Medicaid won't, she can't qualify for a voucher. Is this because our governor is not accepting Obamacare? I had to call New York City to get a donation for $100 for a one-time thing. But we found out last week that she cannot get any more rides. And Viva Medicare told us all of them can't. It's just been cut out. I'm taking care of a mentally challenged 28-year-old girl. Her Medicaid, it's gone up. You know, she didn't have to pay anything. Now it's $5 a visit. If she goes to the hospital, it's $50.
Wow.
So my question to you, is it because our governor is not accepting Obamacare?
The part of Obamacare that he's not accepting that would be what you're talking about is the Medicaid expansion. And I honestly don't know if that has caused them to drop the rides or if it was part of the sequester or if it was some recent piece of legislation. I don't know. I'm sorry. I would like to know. And if anybody does know, you know, give us a call and let us know. And if in other states Medicare does pay for rides to the doctor's office for poor and elderly people, you know, I would like to know that too. Or just, you know, sick people, poor and sick people. And have you called any of the three nationally elected officials? You have two senators and one member of the House of Representatives. Have you called any of their offices and asked that question?
You bet I have, and they don't give me any answers.
They don't know. Okay.
We have we got Sessions and Shelby.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Come on. You know, look what Shelby's just done.
Yeah. Well, you'd think that they might even be bragging about it. I don't know. Siri, I will try to find out, and I'll bring that information back to the show next week, okay?
I would appreciate that.
Okay.
Even Medicaid and Medicare, they're going, we are so sorry. And there are, I don't know how many people in the state that are elderly and sick and cannot get
to the doctor.
And can't get rides.
Right. Okay. Let me look into it. And if anybody out there does know the answer to Siri's question, please let us know. Thanks a lot for the call. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, how you doing today?
Hey, brother, I got a question for you. I live in Manatee County, which is next to Sarasota County on the west coast of Florida.
Mm-hmm.
And these two counties are predominantly, they claim, 85-90% Republican.
Mm-hmm.
And the question I have, Tom, is why is it when the establishment Republicans of government, these two counties, tax and spend for their crony friends and family members and special interest people that work for the government, nice big raises and, you know, more money for this, more money for that. Why is it when they do it, it's portrayed as virtuous and conservative values, but when the Democrats, when they do it, it's portrayed as demonic and socialism? And I'm so sick of it.
Yeah, it's called partisanship, Armin, and you called it out. You know the answer, but, you know, good on you for coming on and laying it out. You did a good job of that. Liz in West Hollywood, California. Hey, Liz, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I have a question. There was a 60s organization called Zero Population Growth.
Right.
And I'm asking what happened to it in relationship to immigration. Because you're the one who's pointed out how much the population increased from 1930s
right.
to now.
Right.
And I looked up the population statistics, and you were correct. And actually, in 1850, there was less than a billion people on Earth, that was estimated.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're 7 billion.
Yep.
And it's not even 1850, it's not even 200 years later that we increased that much.
Yeah.
So I have a solution to this whole immigration issue. I think anybody who wants, we should have an open immigration policy. Anybody who wants to come into this country can be admitted, providing they stipulate to voluntary sterilization.
Oh.
In order to
understand.
Liz,
I know that
we started to travel down that road in the 1920s. It wasn't for the same reason, but the eugenics programs, you know, the American eugenics programs and the posters advertising and promoting them were picked up by Adolf Hitler to promote his program of eugenics, which was called the Holocaust. I understand your intention, but here's the thing. If you want to reduce population growth, empower girls and women. When women and girls have education and political power, family sizes shrink. They shrink below two, which means that over time, populations actually diminish. That's really where we need to put the focus. So maybe you could say, people will say, okay, I promise to educate my girls or something like that. But that's really the way to do it. Liz, thank you for the call. Coming up Monday, we'll have the latest news and information from the weekend. Plus, one elected Tea Party rep is calling on his constituents to stockpile guns. Yes, we will have Noel Flasterstein out about that. And democracy begins with you tag. You're it. See you Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.